DiscerningHearts.com presents The Final Journey, Insights from a Catholic Deacon and Neurosurgeon with Dr. Stephen Doran. Dr. Doran is a board-certified neurosurgeon with over 25 years of experience and is also an ordained permanent deacon and serves as the bioethicist for the Archdiocese of Omaha. He is the author of To Die Well, A Catholic Neurosurgeon's Guide to the End of Life, the book on which this series is based. His writings in bioethics, neurosurgery, and gene therapy for brain disorders have been widely published in national media outlets, academic journals, and neurosurgery textbooks. He is also the co-founder of Seeking Truth Catholic Bible Study. The Final Journey, Insights from a Catholic Deacon and Neurosurgeon with Dr. Stephen Doran. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome back, Steve.
Well, it's so good to be here, Chris. Thank you.
I was surprised, I guess, when I realized that the topic of our next conversation, euthanasia, that it actually, the term euthanasia means a happy death. Is that correct? Or a good death?
Yes. Isn't that ironic? Yes, that's exactly what it means, literally.
It doesn't mean to die well. Hence the name of your book.
That's right.
It's kind of different, isn't it? There's a particular major difference in that, isn't it?
Well, there is. And I think it stems from the perspective of people who do not believe in Christ and heaven and life ever after, that a good death is one that is painless and is easy or happens on your own terms and to your own liking. And so that we've been led to believe that that's the measure of a good death in our society. And there's many, I think, reasons for that. But yeah, society would say that's a good death. But we know, of course, that the most perfect death, of course, of Jesus Christ was anything but a painless death. He was tortured. He was abandoned by most. Yet that's the death par excellence.
When those who contemplate euthanasia to relieve a particular suffering in their lives or what they perceive to be something that is so heavy and so grave that they cannot persevere in life, that can be an argument by some for the reason for it, that there's nothing good about suffering and that we shouldn't have to suffer.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. I mean, that's the driving force. If you see suffering as meaningless, then why should we do anything but try to eliminate it, even if that means creating someone's death or hastening someone's death? If suffering is meaningless, then yeah, of course, let's be done with it. It was interesting. It's not in the book, but I had this conversation with one of my fellow residents from neurosurgery from University of Michigan. He is Jewish, but not practicing Jewish. And he wrote this book about his sister who died and his experience of accompanying her in her grief and things like that. So we had a conversation. I said, is there any meaning to suffering from your perspective, having gone through this? And he immediately said, no, there's no meaning to suffering at all. We may endure certain types of pain for other types of reasons, like you work out hard and so you can get fit, or you know, you do other things, but they're always for an ulterior motive. So for him, having just gone through this process, even writing a book about it for his sister, he still saw suffering as meaningless. And I kind of came away from that conversation a little bit stunned. You would have thought maybe that whole process would have drawn him into more, at least to approach suffering in a way that is something that in some way mysteriously meaningful, but he couldn't come that far. He couldn't make himself go there because the underlying issue is he doesn't believe in God. You know, in the absence of belief in God, I think it is difficult to reconcile the idea of suffering of having any sort of value whatsoever.
For Catholics and Christians, it's understood to be, in some ways, the experience of suffering can be redemptive, that there is a purpose, even though it is, as we understand it, I mean, suffering in itself is an intrinsic evil, yet there is a good that can be drawn out of it by action of grace. As the deacon, I mean, you understand that probably better than most.
I believe in it. Do I understand it? Two different questions, right? It is difficult to understand, right? And it is one of those things that ultimately does become to some degree more or less a matter of faith. I believe that suffering can be redemptive. Do I understand it? Kind of, sort of, not really, because there is a mystery to it, a mystery that we will never fully understand until we're in heaven. You go back and, you know, just in simplest terms, many people probably remember their parents, offer it up, you know, that little simple truism that, you know, was annoying when you're a kid. But there's a lot of wisdom to that that's hidden within that little phrase of offer it up. Now, of course, as a 10-year-old hearing that, I didn't understand it and didn't want to hear it. That just sounded like someone being dismissive of my concerns. But when I look back on it, it's just this nascent sense of what redemptive suffering is, offering something to Christ. And so I'm much more warm to that phrase than I was when I was a kid growing up. It just seems like someone's trying to get rid of me.
There's a possible companion to our understanding of euthanasia, that how did we come to a society where you would actually legalize that? And that companion is a very dark word called eugenics. You have to understand eugenics before you can really wrap your brain around euthanasia, don't you?
Yes, yeah, because that's really where you go back and the roots of it come from. And I don't think people realize that the eugenics movement ultimately is at the foundation of where euthanasia, assisted suicide, came from. And, you know, for those who are not familiar with that term eugenics, I'm sure most of your listeners are, given their backgrounds and intelligence. The eugenics basically was this idea that there are certain people who ought not live. And whether that is because of a race, a religion, which we saw at its most extreme, you know, during the Nazi persecution of the Jews. But even before then, going way back, sadly, in Nebraska history, in 1937, there was a bill that allowed for not only the voluntary euthanasia of adults with sound mind suffering from a fatal illness, but also for the involuntary killing of the mentally incompetent or fatally ill. So this goes way back. Even some articles in the New York Times, you know, quoting the Euthanasia Society of America, which, and these words are harsh, and I only say them because they're out there, they were there, and this is our history, but they sound harsh and they are harsh, and so I guess I apologize in advance, but there's this article that from the Euthanasia Society of America says that incurable imbeciles and persons suffering severe pain should have their misery ended by merciful methods. So immediately at the root of this is a discrimination against the handicapped, for the people who are marginalized. So thank you for bringing this up, because this is not often talked about. Where does this come from? And it comes from this evil sense that certain lives aren't worth living. Certain lives don't have intrinsic value. And that's where it comes from.
A lot of times you were talking about those who, quote unquote, are imbeciles or incompetent. I mean, at that social Darwinism that said that it pollutes the race, that needs to be eliminated. And of course, as a quick footnote, I mean, just look up the origins of Planned Parenthood and birth control and Margaret Sanger and her writings and her what she would say about it. To get back on the topic, that type of what was seen as a burden, not by the individual who had the perceived handicap or were as a part of a particular race, but it was seen as a burden, as it were, for everyone around them. Of course, they would not want to live this way, or they were a drain on society. So it was thought it would be better, possibly sincerely believed, it would be better that they weren't here any longer, and that they should be eliminated.
And ironically, there is this sense of almost like, well, it would be better for society and it would be better for them too. We're doing them a favor. This kind of subversive arrogance and paternalism saying, we know what's best for you and it's better that you don't exist.
Yeah, I can't help but go back to thinking of Blessed Herman the Cripple. Many people may not know about him, but he was a severely deformed child at birth. And his mother could not care for him. And this is, of course, in more of the medieval times, Middle Ages. His mother left him at a door at a Benedictine monastery. And the monks brought him in and cared for him, because their charism is hospice, healing love. And they nurtured this child who grew into a man who was, yes, indeed, severely handicapped, deformed physically. And yet he had a brilliant mind. And he also wrote one of the greatest of all prayers, the Hail Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, and our hope. And that is a particular case in which the one who could not be cared for by his mother, but that community took on to the care and the fruitfulness that was born in nurturing that. See, that's the opposite of that eugenic type of belief system. And it is a belief system, isn't it?
It is. That's well said.
The reason I make such a distinction about the burden on the community is that frequently, of course, in your book, To Die Well, A Catholic Neurosurgeon's Guide to the End of Life, there are many reasons why people will want to enter into this concept of euthanasia for themselves. And part of it is because they believe that they're a burden. And they must have gotten the idea from someone because they just assume I'm going to be a burden and I don't want to do that, that there isn't even that charism available for them of healing love.
Actually, that bears out in the statistics of what people quote, why they would want to have assisted suicide. States like Oregon, for example, where it's legal, they're required to do these reports every year. And so the most frequently reported end-of-life concerns were loss of autonomy, and as 93% of people, that was one of the major reasons for it. And so what they're saying is, if I lose my autonomy, therefore I will become dependent upon other people, therefore I will become a burden. So there's a sequence of that thinking that you have brought out here, Chris, the sense that people, for some reason, feel like they're going to be a burden to others, but where that stems back from is this loss of autonomy. Ironically, fear of pain was a relatively low number of people who wanted to have assisted suicide. I think that for many people, they think that that's the driving force for, people, why they would seek this, but it really isn't. It's loss of autonomy. If you think about that, what it's saying is it's an insult, for lack of a better word, to others, to those who want to love. Like, you're shutting yourself out, and we want to be with you, and you won't. You won't allow us in because you're afraid or you feel like you're a burden. And I mean, one of the greatest gifts that I think a person who's sick, or especially someone who's sick and dying, can do is to allow people in, to allow people to share in that time of grace and blessing. And for the person pursuing assisted suicide, euthanasia, they're doing the exact opposite. They're shutting themselves out because they can't take care of themselves, because they're losing control and they don't want people to help them. So it becomes ultimately, quite frankly, a very selfish act, because you're denying other people this beautiful gift of accompanying them at a very, very holy time.
Yeah, I learned as a young mother whose child, I gave birth to a beautiful, beautiful baby boy who for the first 3 years of his life was just this cherubim of a child, and still was, but he wasn't talking. And then he was tested. And friends, this is early on when we began to really see this bubble of kids with autism. First, I thought I had to grieve the loss of the child I thought I had, that was the trajectory of his life. But what I found was that he was just absolutely perfect, just the way he was. As he's grown and as we've been able to respond to him in love, there was a time when almost 70% of the parents that had autistic children, their marriages ended in a divorce because of the strain. It could help you to grow. It helps the community of the family in loving that child or that person. They're already blessed. My son's going to go to heaven. God's got him. But what about our response to him and how we love him? That's the opportunity that God allows us. And I think it's true for the elderly as well. I think we need to get to a point where in that community, whether it's that smaller community of the family or in the larger community around us, in their suffering, they're the suffering Christ. And we're the community around them. Is how are we going to minister to them? I don't know if our society and our culture has embraced that understanding. Maybe they have in smaller around the world in different community missions. Would you say that's true for maybe in our culture in the United States? I'm being very severe on us, but I don't know if we have a sense of the need for that embrace to help us to be able to grow and our response to them.
I agree with you. I think that, you know, could hypothesize any number of things within our Western culture that could lead to that, whether it's a sense of materialism, a sense of utilitarianism. Things are valued only to the extent that they're helpful. And that's such a dangerous notion, but it permeates so many things, right? We become a throwaway culture across the board, from life issues, the beginning of life, the end of life, to environmental issues, to all sorts of things, that we are indeed a throwaway culture, and we view the world's things and people have value only to the extent that they're useful. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be, and I think, unfortunately, that's where we're at.
Yeah, you bring out in the book the wonderful teachings of Evangelium Vitae by John Paul II, great saint. And as you noted, that first he identified a cultural climate that considers suffering to be an evil to be avoided at all costs. Not just the financial costs, but I mean, it will be something that is, I think the cost can be to the detriment of our own souls. We can't suffer. And that's very unfortunate, isn't it?
It is unfortunate. And coming back to this idea that if you don't believe in God, and especially if you don't believe in a Savior who suffered for our sake, I guess you can come to the conclusion that there's some value to suffering, but I think it's tough. I think that's a tough sell for those who don't believe. And as a result, as John Paul says, well, it has no value, so we should avoid it at all costs because there's no good that comes out of this from that perspective.
We'll return to The Final Journey with Dr. Stephen Doran in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app where you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Monsignor John Essef, Deacon James Keating, Father Donald Haggerty, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more. They're all available on the free Discerning Hearts app. Over 3,000 spiritual formation programs and prayers, all available to you with no hidden fees or subscriptions. Discerning Hearts Catholic Podcasts, dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
An easy way to help Discerning Hearts is to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Our Instagram and Facebook pages are vibrant spaces where you can engage with daily inspirational quotes from the saints, streaming DH broadcast encounters, and updates about our latest offerings. On our YouTube channel, you'll find a treasure trove of video podcasts, interviews, guided meditations and prayers, and reflections from renowned spiritual leaders. These resources are carefully curated to provide guidance, wisdom, and insights that can help you discern life's challenges with a sense of purpose and peace. By subscribing, following, and engaging with Discerning Hearts on these platforms, you're not only enriching your own spiritual journey, but also helping to spread awareness of our mission. Every like, share, and comment helps us reach more people who are seeking meaningful growth and connection. So, please take a moment to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel as well, and then share with a friend. Join the Discerning Hearts community and embark on a transformative spiritual journey alongside fellow seekers. Your engagement not only benefits you, but also contributes to the growth and impact of Discerning Hearts.
We now return to The Final Journey with Dr. Stephen Doran. And usually something like this, there are going to be, which some consider a good, there's always going to be that hook, right? There's a hook that is fed by a lie or an untruth. And in the book, you sign out some of the myths that are fed in the promotion of the moral acceptability of euthanasia, that embrace of a legal good death. I think it's important that we look at those too, don't you?
Yeah, I think because, again, there's this notion that assisted suicide, euthanasia, always has its desired outcome. That is somebody who has a peaceful, serene death surrounded by family or friends or things like that. I think for just one second, I want to draw back in a minute and just so our listeners understand that there's a difference on a practical level, but not on a moral level between assisted suicide and euthanasia, just so they understand. So in the United States, it's legal in several states to have assisted suicide. So that basically means that a physician meets with a patient who is supposed to have been properly evaluated psychologically and physically and agrees to prescribe medications that the patient then typically takes at another time in another place. That's what the United States paradigm of assisted suicide is. Euthanasia is where medical providers are more directly actively involved. And this is what you see in Canada. For example, what they've made euthanasia, they've euphemized or use a different word called medical aid in dying. And in these situations, patients typically are in a hospital, but not always. Sometimes it's done in facilities or even at home where an IV is inserted and certain combinations of medications are given to kill the person. Morally, they're no different. In either situation, you're providing medications that lead to a person's death. But just so people have an understanding between those two methodologies. And ironically, in Canada, the number of patients receiving medical aid in dying, which is euthanasia, is skyrocketing. And in proportion to the United States, given it's a smaller country, way more people, which is ironic. And it may be so, maybe because euthanasia, medical aid in dying is it will work more likely to work than what we see in the United States, where this assisted suicide has problems. I mean, in the sense that from practical problems. So if you have this desire in the United States, you want to die a quiet, peaceful death, and you're going to go see a doctor and they're going to prescribe some medications, and you'll go home and take them and die. Well, unfortunately, I mean, in journals, you know, like the New England Medical Journal, American Medical Association, there's a lot of people who have complications. It doesn't work. They survive, or they have a very painful death, vomiting and all sorts of things that is kind of the antithesis of what they were wanting. And ironically, that's what they have, is anything but a peaceful death like that they were seeking. So that's one of the myths that I think people need to realize in the United States. It isn't what you think it's going to be in some situations.
If I'm not mistaken, for example, in Oregon, they have a pretty established euthanasia act, allowing people to have that sad opportunity, as it were, that even the emotional criteria now in some areas, if somebody is just so, they just don't want to live anymore, that it can be justified.
Well, it used to be you had to have some diagnosis of, say, an incurable disease, cancer, or other, you know, where someone's death is anticipated in some relatively finite period of time. Euthanasia in other countries has really changed, and now you can just have unbearable suffering, for example, is a reason. And of course, how do you define that, right? And so unbearable suffering can be emotional suffering is enough for someone to qualify for assisted suicide, euthanasia in countries, say, for example, like the Netherlands. There really is this slippery slope. And sometimes people will say, oh yeah, slippery slope. Yeah, you always pull out that argument. But it's really true. It's really true that you go from this process at first being only available to people who are close to death to, well, people who have really, really serious illness to, well, people who are suffering to, well, okay, how about kids? The circle of people who become eligible gets wider and wider to almost to the point where the only criteria for euthanasia or assisted suicide in other countries is that you want it. That's enough. That's the only criteria, is that you desire it.
You know what I found extraordinary when I went back and I looked at the criteria as part of the Oregon's Death and Dignity Act, that you have to be at least 18 years old. And for some reason, that just blew my mind to think that even someone at that tender age, I know legally they're adult, but this is finality. Even at 18, that we would put in law that somebody at 18 could decide to end their life with assistance or through euthanasia, it just kind of, maybe it's the mom in me, but that just kind of blew my mind.
I think there is something at the gut level where even if you're neutral or open-minded, like, wow, an 18-year-old? I mean, I know my 18-year-olds were struggling a lot with decisions in their life that were way less consequential than ending your life. And so, yeah, it's hard to imagine that someone at that young age could have the experience, the skills, the support to really, with full knowledge and full understanding, to make a decision like that. And so it makes me concerned that people feel coerced, even if it's not overtly expressed, that they perceive other people want them gone, or they think that other people would be better off without them. And I think it comes back to what you we were talking about earlier, Chris, this idea that people, well, I don't want to be a burden, and yet no one's ever thought of them that way. And so I think it'd be very difficult for a young person to be able to come to that conclusion. This is a reasonable thing to do to end their life. And I worry that they feel, hopefully not overtly, but at least covertly coerced to do this.
Yeah, it goes back to that whole question about the formation of a community. Again, words matter, as we were just talking, even about the definition of what is the origins of the word euthanasia, a good death, that a community is a communion of people. And in particular, a society that has a Judeo-Christian ethic in the Christian tradition, that communion is to be a place of that healing love. It's supposed to be a conveyor of love. And so there shouldn't be a question that that person who is afflicted would be receiving and is a welcomed into a community of love to be nurtured and valued. What does that say about us, again, about who we are and how we need to be present in the world?
I think that's a very good point, because I think people want to see assisted suicide and euthanasia as an ultimate act of freedom for the individual without necessarily realizing, to your point, what is that saying about us as a society? How can it be so bad that you as an individual want to be dead? As a culture and society, it speaks to like, okay, we're failing here. we're doing something wrong here, that a person does not feel that love of community, and they feel so separated from it that they're willing to die or kill themselves because they just don't have that experience. I think that's a very good point.
I keep going back to my own personal experiences, and I hope people will forgive me the indulgence, but I didn't truly appreciate the importance of being that communion until I started bringing communion to an elderly couple who had been married for over 70 years and who had to make a move from an apartment all the way into a one-room nursing home facility. And when the beloved husband, the spouse, who was such a dear man, passed away, his wife, who was bedridden, just couldn't foresee a future without him because he was there all the time. And what I found was it became a response, and I didn't expect it, but being there for her so that she didn't believe that there was so much more. And people began to visit her and care for her and nurture her. And the wisdom that she had and then caring for this person who was not even a technical family member, yet she would live for several years later. And she enriched everybody around her. This is one of those cases that the community didn't reach out in love. She wanted to die initially. She wanted no longer to get her pills, no longer to exist anymore. And because the community responded in love, I don't know if we have enough of that for all of those who are entering into that phase of life right now. I think we could, but I don't know if we're fashioning people in our faith communities to do that.
It's important that we look at euthanasia and assisted suicide in the context of the bigger picture of what we believe who we are as human beings, right? I mean, it comes back to this basic principle that we as a human being are an integrated body and soul, right? We have the breath of God breathed into us at the moment of our conception. And so this idea of dualism, you know, that you cannot mix the sacred with the secular, with that the spirit and the body are separate from each other. So there's this dualistic attitude that permeates our society in so many ways that if we don't see our bodies as an integrated body and soul, and we're just this body, this quote shell, then it makes sense to get rid of it when it's no longer useful. I think for us to address your concerns. Is our community big enough for this? I said, yes, but we have to go back further, though. We have to go back to the roots of this issue, because it's something that impacts so many things in our society, euthanasia, assisted suicide, abortion, all these things, is that we have to be able to see who we are as people and as such, as persons, as body and soul. And then that changes everything. That changes how we approach things at the end of life, at the beginning of life. And so then, yeah, there is enough of a community, but the community itself has to be changed at a very fundamental level of recognizing that, who are we? What are we? You know, we are beloved daughters and sons of God, and we are an integrated body and soul.
Beautifully said. And the thing is, because of that duality, I think that feeds into this idea that we have to release the soul from the burden of the body. And so, as you put in your book that John Paul wrote, euthanasia must be called a false mercy. And it's indeed a disturbing perversion of mercy. I mean, sometimes we say, well, it's an act of mercy. We got to put them out of their suffering.
If you feel like this is just a collection of systems and organs and tissues, then yeah, it's, and they're no different than any other animal. And that's what we do to, you know, animals when they're suffering. We put them out of their misery. You know, that's such a stark phrase, but we've heard it over and over again. And if we fail to see that we are somehow different as human beings, sure, yeah, it makes sense. Put them out of their misery. We do that as a favor to, you know, animals at the end of the life. Wouldn't we do the same for people? Yeah, unfortunately, that can be what the end result of that is. It's a merciful thing to put someone out of their suffering if we don't see them for who, what they really are.
We're a society that can help alleviate the actual physical pain. There is ways of dealing, in some cases, alleviate the degree of suffering. It's the caring of the person, and it's the nurturing of the person that sometimes is what's lacking in availability that causes a different type of suffering, isn't it?
Yes, that's very true. That's very true.
Again, to talk about this particular subject, euthanasia, this is subject for many. They feel, well, I have autonomy. I can determine my own existence, my own destiny. I should be able to do what I need to do. It's difficult for somebody to argue against that unless there is a certain basis of understanding.
I think in Western cultures, we understandably see autonomy and self-determination they're highly valued in Western societies, to the point it becomes an absolute value, and that my autonomy, my self-determination trumps everything else. But they're not. They're not absolute goods. You know, life is a fundamental good. Autonomy, self-determination are not absolute goods. And I think that's where things get upside down, that we value those two things, freedom, autonomy, self-determination, they're absolute goods under all circumstances. And that's where things get really backwards.
As a doctor, but also as a deacon, what would you want to leave as a final thought about this area of euthanasia for the listener?
What I would say is that I think sometimes people think that's one of those things that's just out there that really doesn't have much to do with me. You know, I hear about it. It's really sad, but I'm going to not pay much attention to it because it really doesn't impact me. I would say be mindful that even though maybe it isn't perceived to be directly impacting you, it is. Because what happens is it becomes yet another symptom of the disease that we live under in our culture, the dualism, the separation of the sacred and the secular, which really impacts so many things. Euthanasia is just another example of it. And then from a practical perspective, it is the slippery slope. You know, you can pretend it's not, but if you look at countries, and you just have to look to our neighbors to the north in Canada, the number of people who are getting medical aid and dying has skyrocketed in years. It was a huge percentage of patients in Canada. The number of deaths in Canada who die by medical aid and died, I think it was like 6 or 7%. I'm sorry I don't have the exact number, but it was a staggering number of the total deaths could be attributed to medical aid and dying. And so all of a sudden, it isn't something that's just out there on the fringes. It becomes mainstream. It becomes reality. It's in front of you. I would just encourage people not to kind of, you know, think of this as some problem that's really not my deal, but because it is a problem. It's a symptom of of an underlying disease in our culture, as you might put it, of this dualism, but it's also something that can and will have practical impact on us as this continues to go on.
As a culture, or as a people who we're finding a greater acceptance of all this, what's our attitude and disposition in our own home and with our own family and our own community? Are we creating this communion that would be accepting and nurturing so that a person wouldn't feel that they're a burden or that they have no one to care for them?
That's, I think, a good thing for us to remember, that it isn't just enough to be against this. We have to do something to make it undesirable, right? To make this choice something that just does not appealing to people anymore. And building that community is an important part of that, Chris. You're exactly right. We have to be able to provide an alternative. We have to be able to provide support so that the idea of killing yourself just doesn't even come to someone's awareness.
Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Doran.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. Really enjoy it. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Final Journey, insights from a Catholic deacon and neurosurgeon with Dr. Stephen Doran. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find it within the free Discerning Hearts app or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax-deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for The Final Journey, insights from a Catholic deacon and neurosurgeon with Dr. Stephen Doran.